welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And a little later in the show, we're going to be talking about the big AP news story out of Yemen today. Also going to be talking about new lawsuits filed in response to the inaugural protest. And we'll be talking with former Congressman Dennis Kucinich. But before we can move on, last night, Donald Trump filled up an arena in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, with many of his supporters for a campaign-style rally. He noted, among other things, that, quote, all we do is win, win, win. He went on to praise Gary Cohn and Wilbur Ross for being super rich, saying he didn't want, quote, poor people in their positions, but instead he wanted, quote, great business minds, end quote, who could help revive the economy. Well, not to rain on the president's parade or anything, but they don't really seem to be doing that great of a job or indeed really be doing much winning. The president staked his claim during the campaign on reviving America's manufacturing sector, stumping for votes across the Rust Belt, pledging to bring back factories. It isn't really going that well, though, now that he's actually the president. Over the past 2 years, and just to give you some examples here, the auto industry has accounted for something like 60 to 80% of the gains in manufacturing jobs, as the auto sector has been on the upswing. As Reuters noted this morning, U.S. factory output fell by 0.4% in May, the second decline in 3 months, due partly to a 2% drop in motor vehicles and parts production. And further, in the first quarter of this year, the auto industry accounted for less than 2% of the 45,000 manufacturing jobs created. On Inauguration Day, General Motors laid off 1,200 workers at their plant in Lordstown, Ohio, part of the over 5,000 workers they've laid off this year, including 1,100 in Lansing, Michigan, and 1,000 in Fairfax, Kansas. And just a couple days ago, Ford announced that it's going to build the next generation of Ford Focuses in China. China. This is a particular embarrassment to President Trump, as he had previously intervened when Ford said they were going to move the Focus to Mexico. He got them to back off that, but now they're going to China. Mark Morrow from the Brookings Institution told Reuters, quote, there's no argument with the idea that auto has been pulling the manufacturing sled up the mountain for the last 3 or 4 years. If you take auto out, you're left with a very tepid outlook indeed. And even in manufacturing areas that are doing okay, like Indiana's RV industry, there is a discontent among many of Trump's supporters. And it's a great story, actually, from Reuters. They were talking about how they wanted jobs that were more stable with better benefits. And instead, even though they're making decent money, they're subject to the seasonal booms and busts of the industry and are worked so hard and so aggressively, most workers can only reap the benefits of the higher wages for a handful of years before their body is too destroyed to continue. And when interviewed by Reuters, many of these workers were hearkening back to the era of lifelong factory jobs with high wages and defined pension benefits. Unfortunately, their current work environment is really a glimpse of the future. Work is becoming more intense, less safe, with lower wages and little to no benefits. To give a slightly broader view of this, it's worth looking at a study that made waves last year from Lawrence Katz and Alan Krueger, well-known, highly touted economist. They noted that of the 10 million jobs created between 2005 and 2015, quote, 94% of net job growth in the past decade was in the alternative work category, and over 60% was due to the rise of independent contractors, freelancers, and contract company workers. Just for a little more clarity, they define alternative work as, quote, temporary help agency workers, on-call workers, contract company workers, independent contractors, or freelancers, close quote. So, in other words, the vast majority of job growth in the United States for the past 12 or so years has been in the unstable, no benefits, erratic, and often low wage world of the so-called gig economy. So, make no mistake about it, the only people winning under President Trump are the super wealthy, brilliant business minds for whom he is trying to conduct a $1 trillion wealth transfer in the form of lower taxes. Workers in the Rust Belt are just props in his smoke and mirrors show. The Associated Press is reporting today that the United States is part of a UAE-run series of secret prisons in Yemen where torture is widespread. Over 2,000 men have been disappeared into what now appear to be 18 secret prisons that are in, quote, military bases, ports, an airport, private villas, and even a nightclub. The UAE is operating these facilities with the Saudi puppet government in Yemen that claims to be the official government but only controls the areas occupied by Saudi forces. According to the AP, the U.S. is not directly running the prisons but is deeply involved in the interrogation both directly and indirectly through questions it sends to Emirati security forces to ask those people that they're holding. Those detained are allegedly suspected of being tied to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, but it seems actually like more of just a mass sweep of the area and wanton arrest and torture. The facilities are tied to the secret network of prisons set up by the United States in the wake of 9/11, the so-called black sites to hold and torture terror suspects, often with the torture being outsourced to various allies for plausible deniability. There are now weekly protests by the families of the detained demanding to know what happened to their loved ones. Whatever it is, it's probably not good. One favored torture technique is known as the quote-unquote grill, where a detainee is tied to a spit like a roast and then rotated within a circle of fire. At one detention center, former inmates described to the AP, quote, being crammed into shipping containers, smeared with feces, and blindfolded for weeks on end. They said they were beaten, trussed up on the grill, and sexually assaulted. One inmate said, quote, the entire place is gripped by fear. Almost everyone is sick. The rest are near death. Anyone who complains heads directly to the torture chamber. The same detainee described being beaten with wires and once being locked in a shipping container while it filled with smoke. Some are being held 14 to a cell, while others are herded like cattle, blindfolded into shipping containers with 50 people stacked up against each other. One soldier in an elite unit of Yemenis paid for by the UAE told AP that Americans were often only yards away as the torture took place. Even more ominously, detainees and several officials in the Yemeni puppet government that is in ships off the coast said that there are mysterious Americans interrogating people. Now, the U.S. government is vehemently denying any sort of involvement in that, which raises one question, which is, are there U.S. military contractors being employed by the UAE to help run their torture regime? Now, the U.S. is claiming they don't know anything about any of this. And the UAE is basically saying that this is fake news. But, of course, the UAE and the U.S. have long histories of torturing people. And these actual facilities were set up during the Obama administration. So it obviously isn't fake news. And not really any element of it is hard to believe at all. Well, you remember when Trump said he was going to bring back torture? Well, you may remember a video of police violence from Columbus, Ohio that emerged in early April. It was a cell phone video of 26-year-old DeMarco Anderson being arrested. Anderson was being held down by one officer and by the looks of it seemed to be cooperating and subdued. Then, all of a sudden, kind of out of nowhere, Officer Zachary Rosen walks into the frame and for no reason at all just kicks Anderson in the head so hard that his head bounced back up off the concrete sidewalk like a basketball. Well, the Columbus police chief has put forward his recommendation of what punishment Rosen should face. His recommendation? A one-day suspension. A one-day suspension. Now, this suspension won't necessarily be what happens. The final decision from the director of public safety has not been made. However, it's worth noting that the Columbus police already stated that the actions of Rosen were against their policy and that they were, quote unquote, unreasonable. So it tells you something about the nature of the Columbus police that brutally kicking a defenseless person's head into the concrete for no reason at all is considered a minor offense. It speaks directly to the issue of police murders and police violence in general as well. Things that officers consider to be minor and reasonable or acceptable, the general public view as serious human rights violations, which shows what a folly the accountability mechanisms are for police violence in this country when police are more or less allowed to police themselves. Of course, there's no accountability because, quite frankly, they don't think they're doing anything wrong. They view all criticism and critique as out of bounds and by people who don't understand how sometimes you just gotta kill and beat people for no reason as a part of the job. Either way, let's hope they throw the book at Officer Rosen, but I'm not holding my breath. After negotiating in complete secrecy for some time now, Senate Republicans this morning revealed their version of the American Health Care Act, the Republican replacement for the Affordable Care Act, the so-called Obamacare. In its broad strokes, the bill is more or less the same as the bill that passed the House, but it makes some changes, the general structure, though, keeping totally intact. The centerpiece of the bill is the same as the House bill. Hundreds of billions of dollars in tax cuts for the wealthy that are paid for by a total evisceration of Medicaid expansion. While the Senate bill will phase out Medicaid slower, it will enact a deeper cut. It proposes, like the House bill, to make Medicaid funding to the states on a per capita basis. And after 2025, it'll tie Medicaid to an index that grows pretty slowly on purpose in order to force states to make even deeper cuts to Medicaid. So not only will the expansion be destroyed, but Medicaid overall will be greatly reduced to almost nothing over time. Huge chunks of the poor and a significant number of people in nursing homes get Medicaid. So undoubtedly, millions of people are going to be left out in the cold without health care, without the financial resources to do anything about it. The bill will keep the ACA subsidies funded for 2 years, but lower the threshold for who's eligible, which may keep a few more people who got coverage under the ACA insured for a while. Medicaid reimbursements to Planned Parenthood banned for 1 year. Many Republican senators haven't actually really been able to see the bill. They just saw it this morning when we did. So people are looking through it, perusing it. It's supposed to be brought to the floor next week. There are many divisions, though, within the Republican caucus, and it kind of goes without saying, no Democrats will vote for this, that are going to be difficult for the Republicans to overcome amongst themselves. On Medicaid, it is unlikely senators from expansion states are going to feel all that positively, and with deeper long-term cuts than before, some Republicans in purple states may also see a stumbling block there, at least to their own electability. Senators Rob Portman and Shelley Moore Caputo from Ohio and West Virginia, respectively, are trying to get $45 billion in to help address the opioid epidemic, although their proposal has been widely panned by addiction experts and most other Republicans say they're not for it so far. Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, they've already expressed reservations that the bill doesn't go far enough to repeal Obamacare. Rand Paul says it's Obamacare light, which he also said about the House version. Some reporters have argued Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is trying to ram it through so quickly because he doesn't really care if it passes. And if it fails, by doing it this way, it'll be much easier to pivot to tax reform after having not gotten bogged down in a long health care debate. So over the next week or so, expect the action under the Capitol Dome to be fairly intense as it concerns the future of health care in America. Those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And now as we switch gears here, we are very happy to be joined by former Congressman Dennis Kucinich to talk about what we saw in the special elections that took place on Tuesday. And Congressman, thank you so much for joining us here again on the show. I wanted to get some of your thoughts here on these two additional special election losses for the Democrats, $30 million spent, no victories. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, the amount of money that's spent in these elections is obscene. I mean, if anything, it proves that there's a continuing need to change the campaign finance system because these elections are just being bought. We have yet to learn who gave to the Democrats' campaign, but we can assume who gave to the Republicans' campaign, interest groups that are looking for something from the government that's against the interests of the American people. Now to the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party doesn't have a coherent message. Its economics are blurred because of its obedience to corporate interests. The candidate in the Georgia election could not find himself to take a position for single-payer health care at a time when that kind of a position gave him an opportunity to open up to a vote and bring people out who perhaps wouldn't otherwise care. So, you know, the Democrats also are making, I think, a fatal mistake in making the whole election about Trump. That's what they did in November. They lost congressional seats across the country that they could have won if the candidates had focused on the needs of the people in their district instead of bashing Donald Trump. Now, look, I don't agree with Trump on most things, but I will tell you this, that people who run for office have to say what they stand for, not just what they're against, and certainly not only, you know, not just who they're against. And so the attacks on Trump have failed to succeed in the 2016 election and 2018 elections. Democrats have to come together, get a solid economic program for progressive reform, enable people to put more money in their pockets, to have jobs, to have health care for all, to have education for all, and then maybe the party can begin to resuscitate.
a lot of speculation in the media, especially in the New York Times, by individuals who had previously expressed disillusionment with Nancy Pelosi, saying she's standing in the way of perhaps a more robust economic message and more victories. I mean, do you think a change in the leadership in Congress will make much of a difference at all, or does it really truly come down to message and program?
Well, you got to see who's funding the party. If you change the leaders without changing who's funding the party, what changes? Nothing. So, you know, this is an inherent flaw in a two-party system that's supported by corporations. And it's easy and convenient to demonize Nancy Pelosi, but I'm sorry. It's not as if she's the one who changed Democratic policy years ago where they started to take corporate contributions. So I think we're looking at the necessity of a fundamental change in the political system, which not just rejects corporate contributions, but which causes candidates to say they're not taking any money from corporations, which causes candidates to say that they're not taking money from political parties if that money comes from corporate interests, which opens up to broad solicitation from the general public so people can actually have an impact on elections with a few dollars here and there, adding up to the millions. But just simply changing the leadership of a party, if people think that's going to change the Democratic Party, they're kidding themselves.
Mm-hmm. Final question. A big report coming out today, U.S. involvement in torture in Yemen and also with UAE. It seems like some of these secret prisons were actually set up under President Obama. Is this maybe one of the biggest black marks on his legacy, that he never addressed the Bush era torture and seems to have laid the groundwork for a continued malfeasance?
You have to keep in mind that while President Obama was one of the more talented presidents America's ever had, there were positions imputed to him which he simply did not hold, including standing for peace, including not wantonly using military power in a very singular and private way, witness the drone attacks, including using covert ops to try to kill people. So President Obama's record will continue to be inspected in light of these new developments and new information. And that doesn't make him much different than a number of presidents. But that's where the rub is, because those of us who supported him at first thought he would be different.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't.
Indeed. Well, former Congressman Dennis Kucinich, thank you again for joining us here on By Any Means Necessary.
Thank you so much. Bye now.
And that is going to do it for this segment. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about some of the continued aftermath, if you will, of protests that happened here in Washington, D.C. on January 20th, the day of the inauguration, which, as listeners of this show know, had quite a bit of running wild by Metropolitan Police in Washington, D.C. And we are very happy to be joined by Scott Michaelman, who's of the ACLU D.C. chapter and is the filing attorney in a lawsuit that the ACLU just filed here in D.C. Against the police department, Metropolitan Police Department, for a number of things that they did. Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So just to set the stage here in terms of what's going on, and I know that everyone, I said people have heard this, many of our listeners have heard it, but for those who may be tuning in for the first time, I wanted to talk a little bit about what actually took place there on January 20th. And to set the stage, it's the inauguration day. If you've never been to D.C., big deal. There's a whole big parade, the whole nine. Many, many thousands of people, Scott, came to Washington, D.C. To protest, to express their opposition. And then the police and had a response. So tell us a little bit about what took place there that you all are concerned about.
Sure. Well, on Inauguration Day, as happens on really all Inauguration Days and many other days here in the nation's capital, a lot of people came to express their views. And a lot of people, as you know, are in opposition to this president and came here to express their opposition to this president. What happened, unfortunately, is that amidst a mainly law-abiding demonstration that was one of many demonstrations that took place in the district that day, there was some law-breaking. There were some trash cans knocked over. There were some windows broken. And in response, the police moved with aggressive and excessive force to confront not only people who were breaking laws, but everyone who was anywhere near that activity at that time. And so what happened was a massive response that pepper sprayed hundreds of innocent law-abiding demonstrators and ultimately detained hundreds of demonstrators as well without any proof or probable cause that those people had been involved in any lawbreaking on that day.
I mean, yeah, I think this is, I almost wish everyone listening could have seen it. I was on my way here, actually, to the Radio Sputnik studios to record that day, walked through an area where a number of these police were. There was nothing going on in this intersection at the time, and they're still just, like, firing these, like, flashbang grenades. I mean, it really was unbelievable on so many different levels. And I want to touch one thing here that I think is very relevant. This was... I don't want to say unexpected for those of us who do a lot of protesting, but in some ways, a return to the past for the police in Washington, D.C. I mean, because of many things that I know have happened over the years, I've been here since 2004. The Barham case that I know was filed by the Partnership for Civil Justice and things that happened in terms of the D.C. Council. You know, there's a number of things that were put in place to try to get the police to act in a way that respected people's First Amendment rights. And now you have this new police chief, acting police chief, Peter Newsom. He was coming in. It seemed to me, at least, that he was trying to send a message about what the Metropolitan Police was, how they were going to react to mass protest activity in the District of Columbia.
I think it absolutely sends a message, Eugene. You're right about that. And you're also right about the troubled history of the MPD in responding to largely peaceful demonstrations at which there might be a little bit of law breaking. They have overreacted massively on a number of occasions. And in fact, the D.C. Council tried to rein in the police by passing the D.C. First Amendment Assemblies Act. And that is one of the claims in our lawsuit, or several of the claims, actually, is that MPD violated that act in spite of the D.C. Council's attempts to rein the police in. Instead, they sent a very clear message on January 20th that that they were not going to tolerate not just lawbreaking, but people even in the vicinity of lawbreaking. And that sends a dangerous and chilling message that if you come to the nation's capital, you can't rely on the police to respect your First Amendment right to express your views. And that's very dangerous.
I think that's a good point. I mean, you know, the First Amendment rights are equally as important everywhere. I don't want to suggest that they aren't, but it does seem like the District of Columbia has a very particularistic reality to it as well that means there should maybe be extra scrutiny on what the police do here, perhaps, because, you know, this is the nation's capital. Everyone who has an issue that they feel strongly about that the federal government can address, people who want to be on the national stage, be on the international stage, people who are often shut out of you know, a lot of big media and are looking to find a way to get themselves in the conversation, come here to Washington, D.C. To express their feelings. And if people feel I can't come to D.C. and protest and exercise my rights that I have, it seems like it's a big blow to the body politic.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, with D.C. being the center of the nation's government, this is where people should be freest to express their beliefs, their opposition, their dissent, their concerns. And the MPD's reaction on January 20th sends the message, we're not going to tolerate that here. In fact, we're going to punish you for it. And we're going to react with maximum aggression to go after not just people who are breaking laws, but people who are near people who are breaking laws, people who are expressing the same views, who are on the same street as people who are breaking laws. And that's really dangerous because the heart of our democracy is dissent, different viewpoints, debate, and discussion. That's how this country moves forward. And that's the only way it ever has.
And, you know, I think one of the things that, and I believe you touched on this a little bit earlier, but I know that has upset a lot of people, has been the arrest of journalists. And some of the people who they arrested initially who were journalists, they, I think, dropped the charges. But I believe there's still four people at least who are journalists who have charges of different sorts. I mean, it really seems like the just sort of wanton nature of the way they did this and the fact that they were willing to just openly arrest people who I think some of them even were like had the press passes. It wasn't like it was a confusion about them being journalists. Just seems to show the lack of respect for the constitutional rights of people that that was going on that day.
That's right. And I think the extent of the arrest really reveals how blanket this approach was. So one of our clients in our lawsuit is a photojournalist who was pepper sprayed as he was finishing taking a photograph when the officer could see the large professional grade camera around his neck. He was subsequently arrested and spent more than a day and a half in custody. Another of our clients is a legal observer who is wearing the distinctive neon green legal observer's hat and was pepper sprayed without warning for being near the area where other demonstrators were being held, but without himself menacing the police or threatening in any way. They just opened fire with their pepper spray.
Wow. Well, and I know that there's also a case where I believe there was some searches that went on that were a little beyond the pale from my opinion. Talk to us about that a little bit, if you could.
Absolutely. So the conditions of confinement to which the demonstrators were subjected were quite unusual and quite bad, culminating in these manual rectal searches. So what happened was hundreds of demonstrators were detained that day on a street corner for hours. Denied food and water and access to toilets for hours as they were processed slowly and transported in vans slowly. And so many of them were hungry and uncomfortable. Some of them had to relieve themselves on the street. One officer told a woman to her pants to prove that she really had to go. And then the culmination of it for two of our clients was that they were lined up in a police training facility with three other detainees, and all of them were asked to drop their pants. And an officer moved down the line, grabbing them by the balls and sticking his finger into their anuses and wiggling it around. Again, with no justification, with no purpose other than to harass and degrade and humiliate these people for no other reason than they had been on the street that day and happened to have been arrested by MPD.
Unbelievable on so many different levels. I mean, really, it's like a lot of the horror stories you hear out of prisons, just lining people up and abusing them for no reason other than your own. One of the things that I think we talk a lot about on the show is a lot of the technology and things that are at use here, the weapons and the things that police do, the nature of militarization. And I know that there was some back and forth between MPD and protesters like the day after about whether they were using these concussion grenades, whether they weren't using them. I think they were saying they weren't at first and maybe they backtracked. But I mean, in terms of the flashbangs, the concussions, the pepper spray. I mean, the use of all these sort of militarized cloud control mechanisms. What kind of concerns do you have around that?
Yeah, the weapons that the police were deploying that day were of many different types and with the potential to seriously injure people. From the concussion grenades, the flashbang grenades, the pepper spray, the a device called an LRAD, which emits a very high sound and is the subject of a lawsuit in New York. The police really came out in force that day. And again, when police go from sort of 0 to 60 that fast, from skipping over the warnings, skipping over the dispersal orders, and going straight to high tech chemical based weapons and other aggressive crowd control devices. Again, it sends that chilling message because people who want to come to the nation's capital to express their views are going to think twice. They're going to think to themselves, do I want to put myself in the line of fire when the fire in question is going to be, for instance, chemical irritants that burn a person's lungs, cause a person to choke, cause skin to peel? It's quite chilling.
Yeah, no, I mean, it really is. Again, you know, people who can go look at, if you're listening to this, go also look online, go look at YouTube and look at some of the videos that people caught of the way it went down. I mean, you know, it's almost like these people dress like they're from another planet coming down and shooting things at people. Very, very interesting play. I mean, you know, one of the things I think a lot about here too is, you know, what's the balance? I mean, you know, you show up for a protest. I show up for a protest. Anyone shows up for a protest. If it's public, anybody can come, right? So if anyone can come to anything that's public, I mean, it just seems like this, the First Amendment also should protect you from this kind of just, and I think this is what you're alluding to, that the actions of others, that in a large crowd, if someone does something that is, you know, whatever, quote unquote, illegal, it is what it is, but it doesn't mean that I, in fact, and the person who should be caught. And so I wonder if the way these things are policed in and of themselves make it difficult, because in an event where, you know, sometimes it can be hard to sort of single out who's who and what's what, if you just immediately crack down, you chill protest, and you might not even get the right people anyway. I don't know. Where's the balance there?
Well, certainly the police may properly arrest people who are breaking the law. The problem comes in when they move beyond those individuals to everyone who maybe looks like those people or espouses the same message or is in the same place. And so guilt in our system is personal. It's not associational. It's not a virus you can contract by being nearby. So they need to focus on investigating and arresting people who are actually breaking laws. And that can be a difficult task. And I don't think anybody's saying that any police officer's job is an easy one. But one of the core roles of a police officer is to distinguish people who ought to be suspects, people who are reasonably suspected of having broken the law, from other innocent people. And if they can't do that, then you have what you had on Inauguration Day, which is mass roundups and mass arrests based on policing by guilt by association.
Well, and you certainly may not know this yet, because I think it's all been filed. You've filed this against the Metropolitan Police Department. Obviously, on Inauguration Day, anyone who's been here, there's a interlocking security structure at all. I mean, is there any thought, any feeling or indication that there may be some, it's not just MPD, I guess. Maybe that's the role I'm looking for.
Sure. I mean, that's definitely a possibility that we're considering, that maybe there are other officers, other agencies that bear some responsibility here. But our main focus is on MPD, because that is most of who we've seen mm-hmm. in the videos, in the pictures. That's who our clients interacted with. That's what we've gleaned from public statements going all the way up to Chief Newsom about who was handling the situation on the ground and who was making the decisions about what was going to happen to the demonstrators that day.
Well, you know, one of the things, just process-wise, so you filed this lawsuit in federal district court. So before I get too far away, so what are the next steps? I mean, does it get before a judge? Is there, what happens next?
So the course of litigation is notoriously difficult to predict. But broadly speaking, defendants in civil lawsuits can respond in one of two ways. They can either say, we're going to challenge you on the law, we don't think your claims are valid claims, or they're going to fight us on the facts and say, we don't think what you say is true. And they can take either of those paths, and which one they pick will dictate how we respond, whether we have to start by making legal arguments to demonstrate to the judge that these are valid claims, or we go straight into fact discovery where the parties exchange information and we learn more about who did what that day.
You know, one of the things, and we've had a couple people on this show, sort of on the other side of this, the folks who are facing the criminal trials from the state. I'm always curious, there's sort of two different processes, two different issues. Do the two things affect each other at all, or is it two totally separate pieces?
Well, I think the main thing to recognize when we talk about chilling effect and the chilling effect of the police conduct that day on future demonstrators, that carries right over into the criminal process. And so demonstrators are going to be chilled by the pepper spray and the mass arrests. They're equally, or perhaps even more, going to be chilled by the aggressive and unwarranted conduct of the United States attorney in pursuing indictments on the basis of guilt by association. So you have people who showed up to express their views lawfully, didn't do anything unlawful, didn't plan to do anything unlawful, didn't encourage anyone to do anything unlawful, and yet they're facing multiple felony counts because the U.S. attorney has decided that they're going to go after lawful protesters for some reason. And that, you know, even if they beat those charges, future protesters will be chilled. They will say to themselves, do I want to go to a district where the United States attorney is going to prosecute me just for expressing my views and take the risk that someone in the crowd is going to do something unlawful and then they're going to have these massive indictments come down on their head.
No, it certainly would give me pause, and I think many other people. I mean, one thing that I'm also sort of curious about in relationship to that, and again, this is just me. Is it a stretch, given to see that, especially since it's coming from the U.S. Attorney's Office, but it just seemed to me that for this to happen on Trump's inauguration day, when he had been so vociferously kind of suggesting to some degree that there should be more of a crackdown on protest and protesters and so on and so forth, and the whole idea of inculcating law and order, that maybe this was, you know, it wasn't an accident that it happened on this day, this way with some of these players.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thought. It's certainly not something that I'm in a position to know. But certainly, if you step back and look at the broader context, it's very concerning in sort of electing this extremist, law and order, punitive figure that's now in the White House, and to have his administration kicked off with aggressive policing and aggressive prosecution to the point of to the point of the unconstitutional actions of the police and the chilling and concerning approach of the prosecutor to these guilt by association indictments. It all is very troubling, and it sends a message that the Trump administration is not shy about sending, that it doesn't want to hear from the other side. It doesn't like dissent, doesn't particularly think much of the First Amendment, and thinks its critics should shut up and go away.
As someone who is a civil liberties attorney, and this is sort of a broader question, I mean, I'm sure you probably got into this work obviously well before Trump, so it's not the impetus of it. But does the work you do almost seem to take on an extra imperative now in this era?
It does. I mean, certainly amidst my own sort of grief and concern for the country in the wake of the election, something that gave me comfort was getting up and going to work every day and thinking, well, I'm in a position to do something, even small somethings about it. So certainly in this time, we just feel that much more responsibility because the Constitution is so threatened by this administration.
Excellent. Well, Scott Michaelman, thank you so much for joining the show. He is an attorney with the ACLU. DC filed this lawsuit here. Definitely follow it, ACLUDC.org. Stay up with everything they are doing. We are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about more atrocities in Yemen. Many people, I'm sure, have seen the AP News story there related to torture and the U.S. involvement. And we are very happy to be joined for this conversation by Medea Benjamin, who's the co-founder of Code Pink. Medea, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me on, Eugene.
So I just want to start with maybe your first impressions upon seeing this story this morning of the U.S. being involved with the UAE and the quote-unquote so-called Yemeni government and torturing potentially thousands of prisoners.
Well, I didn't know about this. I found this absolutely astounding. You know, the U.S. was so implicated in the Abu Ghraib torture and the torture in Guantanamo. And even though Donald Trump has said that he thinks torture is useful and just fine, I didn't know that the U.S. was involved and that this level of torture was going on in Yemen. We've been focusing so much on the tragedy of the bombs, the Saudi-led coalition, the blockade of humanitarian aid coming in, the outbreak of cholera, and then to find out that on top of all that, there are thousands of prisoners who have been tortured or gone missing is really pretty astounding and horrifying.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And one interesting facet of the story that is still a little strange to me, and I wish the AP would have explained it a little better, but I guess these secret prisons that they're using actually were set up by the Obama administration after they dismantled the black sites. And I just, you know, in retrospect, I think you and I have talked about this before, but it just, again, to me, says that for the maybe the biggest black mark on the Obama administration has to be that they did almost nothing about they did nothing about the torture in the Bush era, and it seems now have been facilitating, at the very least, a torture network that grew out of the black site situation.
That's true. I think the fact that the Obama administration did nothing about the abuses of the Bush regime, whether we're talking about the torture, the presence of Guantanamo, or the use of drones, meant that Obama felt free to carry on some of these policies, ignore some of the policies, give symbolic condemnations of them. But when you don't not only go back and talk about what happened, but do something to hold people accountable, you keep it wide open for what we're seeing today. And with the Trump administration, it seems like all restraints are off.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the other elements here is it seems that the UAE was playing a key role involved in this, and obviously playing a key role involved in the war in Yemen and the terrible things that are going on. But it just seems that it's another the reflection, perhaps, is the word I'm looking for here, of how the U.S. sort of quote-unquote rhetoric, although there's very little now under Trump, about human rights is on so many levels hollow, given some of the allies that we have and that we work with on a regular basis and extol day in, day out.
Well, the two main allies in this war in Yemen are Saudi Arabia, which is infamous for the abuses that it practices both internally and the groups that it supports externally, and the Emirates, which also is known to practice torture domestically, something that the Obama administration, as well as now the Trump administration, has to know because it's been so well documented. It would be a big stretch to think that the U.S. didn't know that there was a real risk of torture in working with the Emirates. And the Emirates are the ones that are more on the ground, while the Saudis are the ones more in the air. Now, the Saudis could care less about civilian casualties. They feel that when they're killing Shia, they're doing God's work. And the Emirates, obviously, are pretty much the same. And we're talking about huge numbers. We're not talking about a report, and these are credible sources. This is Amnesty, the AP, not talking about dozens or hundreds. They are talking about thousands of Yemeni men who have been disappeared into these networks. So we don't know the level of U.S. complicity, but we do know the U.S. complicit is complicit. And we know that these are terrible crimes, horrendous human suffering. When you read through it, it just makes your stomach churn. And it is absolutely disgusting that our government has been complicit in this.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I was actually shocked at how many high-level officials they had inside of the Hadi government in Yemen who were talking about this. I mean, you know, one other thing that struck me, and we, you know, we'll have to wait and learn more about this, but one aspect of the story for those who haven't read it is that a number of people were reporting to AP that there are these ships that are just off the coast where U.S. some Americans are doing involved in this torture. There was some speculation on the AP's part that they might be military contractors. And I just said to myself, you know, of all the things that have been unleashed, I mean, it really is just such a damning statement about the whole sort of U.S. war on terror thing, that there now could be these private military contractors being hired by countries like UAE and then putting to work what they undoubtedly learned in these CIA black sites in Guantanamo for large sums of cash for hire. I mean, it really just seems like an ominous, if it's true, an ominous reality.
Well, there were contractors that were used already in Abu Ghraib, and the U.S. military now has more contract people than it has full-time people in the U.S. Positions. And so it shouldn't be surprising the contractors are being used. But now, as you say, it's also being used through third parties. But this is also very believable, given that people like Eric Prince, who has started out his career by being contracted by the U.S. military, then went global and moved to the Middle East and actually to the Emirates to set up shop there. So I'm sure there is a lot more to learn about the contracting of mercenaries in this use of torture. And then we should also say, Eugene, that we're talking about, your audience might know a lot about the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia because that's been in the news, but they might not know that the Emirates, the ones being accused now of this level of torture of Yemenis, are also a major importer of U.S. weapons. And according to our laws, if they are engaged in this kind of activity, then we should not be able to sell them these weapons. So it will be interesting to see if we could get any of our Congress people to take it to that next level.
Mm. It will certainly be interesting. I mean, I'm curious how you feel about what's been going on in terms of Congress and the Saudi arms deal. I mean, you know, certainly not as successful perhaps as many of us would have liked to see, but it does seem that in Congress there's more appetite than there's ever been to restrict these weapon sales to some of these absolute monarchies?
Well, it depends if you're a glass half empty or half full kind of person. I usually am the half full, but I'm so disgusted that Congress would sell any weapons to the Saudis, the Emirates, when it has been clear in U.S. cables, thank you, Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange, that we knew that the Emirates and Qatar and the Saudis were financing al-Qaeda-type groups throughout the region. So then we go ahead and we sell them weapons, that the weapons end up in the hands of these very groups that we are supposed to be fighting against. So the fact that there would be one senator who would be voting in favor of selling more weapons to the Saudis disgusts me. But yes, given the collusion between our elected official and the military-industrial complex, I guess we did pretty good by getting 47 senators to say no to this weapon sale. But let's also be clear that while the weapon sales are, we're talking about over $100 billion, this particular sale was less, was about $500 million. So it was a, quote, minor sale in the larger scheme of things. Mm. And even there, we were not allowed to stop it. It was 20 more senators than we got at the last vote, so it is definitely moving up. And so there is some progress there. But once again, Eugene, I don't know about you, but it really makes me sick to think that 53 senators would vote in favor of selling weapons that they knew were going to be used in Yemen, where there is the largest world catastrophe going on right now. The Saudis deliberately trying to bring Yemen to the brink of famine so that it will win its part of the war. And 53 senators were saying, yes, let's go ahead and help them with that.
Yeah, unconscionable, really. Unconscionable, given everything we've seen and that we know out of Yemen. And speaking to especially the use of famine as war, you know, one of the other things I've personally found quite disgusting of recent days. So the king of Saudi Arabia has now named his son, I believe, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, as they call him, to be the next in line when he dies. And I guess he's already suffering from dementia. So who knows? He'll get in there. But the U.S. media continually portrays him and say, well, Mohammed bin Salman, he's a modernizer, with sort of the subtext of modernizer being like, he's good. He's more pro-Western. More like you, basically, you reader of the New York Times or Washington Post. And it just seems to me to be just totally unbelievable, because almost all of the things that people are condemning Saudi Arabia for around the world right now are things he supports or created.
Well, that's right. It is really remarkable. They just use the fact that he's 31 years old to say, oh, isn't this cool, this young guy, and he's got a modern view, and his vision for changing the Saudi economy is one of diversifying, and he's got his vision 2030 of what the Saudi Arabia system should look like. Give me a break. I mean, this is a guy who started the war in Yemen, who is responsible for the devastation there. He is the one who is responsible, I would say, for the terrible crisis that's going on with Qatar right now. He is somebody who is brash, who is not willing to use diplomacy over military intervention or a cessation of diplomatic ties. And he is taking us on the road of even greater catastrophe in the Middle East, because I think this young guy, even though he can't win against the tribal Houthis, thinks perhaps that it's time to go to war with Iran. So I think it's very dangerous that he has he'd already been very powerful because his father had given the portfolios of both the military and the economy. You can't get much bigger than that. But now that it's been stamped that he will be the next king, I think it's extremely dangerous.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. And it certainly seems that the Iran situation, U.S., Russia, Iran, I mean, things are on a knife's edge. And actually, Korea, too. I know the president of South Korea is coming here next week. I'm sure there'll be a lot of controversy over the issue of that and what's going on with that. I mean, it really does just seem that the world in general is kind of on a knife's edge right now, and the actions of the U.S. government are not the only one, but certainly could kind of tip it one way or the other. But there's still not inside of any sort of governmental structure, any sort of really sort of pro-peace, anti-war constituency that exists out there. I mean, is it that people are hungry? Is it that they're for war? Are people confused? Is the propaganda effective? I mean, what do you think is the state of why they're able to do so much with such limited opposition at this stage in the game?
Yeah, well, I think we haven't done a good job ourselves as people who have been dedicated to building up opposition to war. I think it's extremely confusing. People don't know what to make of what's going on in Syria, and you hear such different things. And I also think that it becomes the norm to be a war, because for younger people, this country has been in war for most of their lives. And I also think that the way that the media covers it is very confusing to people. And the fact that we don't get the coverage that makes people sympathetic with the victims makes it just kind of this faraway, low-grade cancer that's happening out there that there's nothing much we can do about. And you know, Eugene, we have tried and we must continue to try harder. I'm feeling these days that we've just got to almost go from square one right now and get people together in a room and say, what are we going to do to build real opposition? Because as you're saying, we're just careening into greater and greater catastrophe, certainly in the Middle East. And there is the issue that you brought up about North Korea. I think the tragic death of that young American traveler to North Korea is also going to have consequences in terms of evoking a sense of revenge from the Trump government, and who knows what that's going to look like. So we're in dangerous times, and we are nowhere near at the level we need to be in terms of opposition. So, yes, we need to come up with a new strategy.
Yeah, certainly. Well, you know, we're going to see how it all unfolds here moving forward. I will say it does just sort of seem like at the end of the day, though, whatever is going to come, it's going to come from, you know, people and organizations outside of the established political structure. I mean, maybe if there's someone you could think of, let me know right now. But I don't see any, you know, sort of congressperson emerging as someone who's going to be leading any sort of resistance on this level, at least.
There are individuals who are good on certain issues. You know, I hate to say it, but our Republican friend Rand Paul is about the most consistent on these things. Mm-hmm. Of just his view of, oh, why are we outside of our boundaries at all, is something that's important. And while we have people like Chris Murphy, the senator from Connecticut, who's been very good on this Yemen issue, he will always couch it in terms of, well, you know, the Saudis are our allies and we need to work with them for stability in the region, but, you know, maybe we should stop this little arms deal. So, yeah, you don't find a lot of people in the officialdom, and we haven't talked about Israel-Palestine, but certainly when it comes there, even when some Congress people will take a mild stand of saying maybe we should do some more to protect the children of Palestine, or maybe we should care about in Gaza right now, they're getting 3 hours of electricity a day, that is seen as too much by some of the Israeli lobby groups, and then they get pounced on by those organizations.
Yeah,
so we're in a tough space. Yeah, we haven't created enough space for some of our elected officials to come out as true peace advocates.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, certainly what they're going up against is quite significant. I mean, the military-industrial complex, the institutional interest of all these different countries who are their quote-unquote allies, just the interest of Pentagon planners and people who want to take over the entire world. I mean, it does seem that really there's maybe more than any other issue on war and peace issues, the lobby of people against you moving out of the sort of State Department Pentagon status quo is the greatest.
Yes. On the other hand, except for the issue of Israel-Palestine, there isn't much of a constituency that's on the other side. When we went into lobby against weapon sales to Saudi Arabia, Eugene, we'd say in each office we went, have you been getting constituents calls saying, yes, please sell more weapons to Saudi Arabia? And, you know, they'd say, well, not really, you know. There's nobody on the other side except the lobbyists in this case. I mean, in the case of Israel, we've got to admit that the strong lobby group AIPAC has a grassroots base, and they can mobilize in every single district real people. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, there's not constituents. We are the constituents that care about most of these issues, and yet we haven't done a good enough job of organizing our people so that our voices can counteract not other constituents, but the powerful lobby interests.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, I really appreciate it. Medea Benjamin, again, that's who you just heard. She is the co-founder of Code Pink. That is going to do it for us here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.